Welcome to the New Hampshire Secrets, Legends, and Lore podcast, where twice a month we explore the world of New Hampshire that lies outside of the hard news. I'm your host, Wayne King, and I invite you to join us for an adventure that will take us on a journey together to explore those things that are unlikely to make the pages of your newspaper, the waves of your radio station, or the bits and bytes of your favorite news website. Yet for many of us, these stories will reveal what makes life here in the Granite State truly worth living. Together we'll uncover some secrets, speculate on a few rumors and legends, and we'll meet the people and a critter or two, both living and long departed, who weave together the colorful tapestry of New Hampshire's past, as well as some who are helping to build our future. We'll explore places known and unknown that you will want to add to your bucket list. We'll laugh together, gasp together, and maybe even shed a tear or two. The shushes along the way, the birth of freestyle skiing at Waterville Valley, the untold story of the birth of freestyle skiing. Hot dog skiing was a purely American innovation and a celebration of diversity. This is a three-part audio podcast celebration of the people and events that shaped the birth of freestyle skiing. From Anamaki Chronicles and InDepthNH.org. It is often expressed regarding American culture and innovation that California is a primary source for new cultural trends and ideas. Yet in the early 1970s, a little town at the end of the road in the White Mountains of New Hampshire became a focal point for an innovation in alpine skiing, an innovation that in only a few short years would sweep across the nation and the world, freestyle skiing. And that's what this series is all about. The birth of freestyle skiing. Part one will be the dreamers and the doers. The 1960s were a time of excitement and innovation, driven by people from all walks of life. The growth and development of Waterville Valley and the explosion of freestyle skiing was no exception. Consequently, telling the story of both the birth of freestyle skiing and Waterville requires that we open our minds to what happens when we mix blue blood North Country families like Ralph and Grace Bean and their two boys, Danny and Dave, Olympic skiers like Tom Corcoran and his friends, Doug Pfeiffer, editor of Skiing Magazine, the Kennedys of Massachusetts, with immigrant-made good dynasties in the making, like the Dunphys, and college students lured to the valley by a love of the mountains and skiing, like John and Donnie Hughes, and other accomplished and talented long-timers like Raymond Brocks and his family. These were the dreamers and the doers. They were joined by the mentors and the protectors, which will be part two of the series. The mentors and the protectors were the men and women who had fallen in love first with skiing and then with freestyle and its devil-may-care skiers. They brought their wisdom and enthusiasm to the sport. people like J.D. Nelson, Jack Sanders, and Bernie Weichel, who on more than one occasion rescued freestyle from the jaws of extinction in a society increasingly placing bumpers and belts on our lives and on our bodies to protect us from ourselves. Nick and Susie Preston, who provided the pushback by helping the athletes push the envelope safely, building their bodies, their confidence, and their skills to protect them. And then in part three, we turn to the athletes, the people who really made this sport. Add to that athletes like Wayne Wong, George Askewald, Floyd Wilkie, Billy Fallon, among others. Frank Du Bois, the nation's first African-American certified ski instructor, and ski school director Paul Fosey, who had the vision to see beyond the backbiting and competitiveness between racers and freestylers. What was created was a North Country stew of enthusiasm, fearlessness, talent, and determination from which would emerge the most thrilling and innovative changes to alpine skiing since its inception. The men and women who led this revolution in skiing were a diverse, freewheeling, and welcoming group of people, multicultural, multi-ethnic, from every socioeconomic level, every religious and non-religious background. It seemed the epitome of everything that our founders had dreamt of, a pluralistic wave moving us forward to match the other changes taking place all over the country and the world. We were a country and a people on the move, a people who served as a paradigm of everything that we could be, where the athletes, mentors, and dreamers made us excited about the future by providing us with an examples of courage and enthusiasm that matched our own personal vision of what was best in America. And the changes were not just social and political. We became aware quickly that as the country advanced and pluralism grew, so too did the economic power of the country. Rope tows and cow pastures yielded to T-bars and then chairlifts servicing triple black diamond slopes like True Grit and Bobby's Run. Named for Waterville Valley's fallen favorite son, Robert F. Kennedy Sr., felled by an assassin's bullet during the 1968 presidential primary. The changes also led to a thriving and exploding economic sector of the market around winter sports. Suddenly, the choice of skis went from Northland and Head to dozens of new companies offering the most innovative skis and the safest of bindings. And it wasn't enough to have one size ski. You had to have four or five pairs, each equal to the challenges of the specific task in freestyle. Even ski wear saw an economic explosion. And who can forget Olympian Susie Chaffee announcing that her new nickname was now Susie Chapstick as the athletes discovered the power of their names and endorsements in the marketplace. Now, some of the most important people in this story are no longer with us, and we regret that we have not yet found a way to fully acknowledge their contributions to the sport. And we ask for your indulgence in this shortcoming. Furthermore, if you have ideas about ways in which we can fill those gaps, we'd love to hear from you. Perhaps there are some future podcasts that can be blended with this to provide an even more robust overview of the historical picture. Some of the giants are still with us, and we have tried to interview many of them for their input. Weaving together their stories and the overall story of the birth of freestyle created the set of choices for us in telling the story. Should we simply glean the little bits and pieces of the interviews that directly related to the freestyle story and ignore the color and culture of the times expressed during the course of the interview? Or should we find a way to present their stories more fully and still maintain the through line of the freestyle birth story? We've chosen to take a bit of a hybrid approach on this as a result. We've included some of the individual interviews as a separate entity, giving you, the listener, the opportunity to click through to some of the individual interviews as you shush through the story over the next month to hear more from the people who played a central role in the birth of freestyle. In our show notes for each episode, we will provide links to those interviews. So now it's on to the series, and we begin today with the dreamers and the doers. You can't talk about the birth of freestyle skiing without at least a little bit of background on Waterville Valley itself, because one of the most prominent ski areas in the eastern United States did not just emerge as if by magic. The deepest roots of Waterville Valley, of course, lie in 20,000 or more years of history within the domain of the Algonquin Archaic Indians and their descendants, the Abenaki or Wabanaki people, the people of the Dawn Land. Early efforts within the colonial era focused on Waterville Valley as a summer resort, while the area and the economy awaited the days when skiing would become the primary source of the valley's recreational attraction. The Waterville Inn, preceded by an even earlier inn called the Greeley House, were part of a summer escape phenomenon in the White Mountains, most famous for the many grand hotels scattered around the Whites. Every summer, thousands of city dwellers would escape the stifling heat of the cities with their hiking boots and steamer trunks, coming for months at a time. But sometime in the late 1950s and early 60s, Waterville's bread and butter began to turn toward winter sports. Waterville's evolution into superstardom began with a small ski area known as Snow's Mountain in Waterville Valley, across the valley from Mount Tecumseh, where today's ski resort would be developed on National Forest land. Though a few earlier owners took some baby steps, Snow's Mountain really came into its own when Ralph Bean, a combat veteran of World War II and the sole heir of a Lowell, Massachusetts shoe manufacturing family, inherited about 400 acres of land, representing most of the private land in the valley. Ralph and his wife Grace Bean partnered with Raymond Brocks, also of the Lowell area. A previously existing rope tow was already on the land, but not operational. According to Raymond's son, Bill Brocks, Raymond told Ralph that he could get that old rope tow running, and sure enough, he did. This began a dedicated friendship between Ralph Bean and Raymond Brocks. Ralph even gave Ray 2 acres of land in a prime part of the valley on which Ray could build a winter home in Waterville to show his gratitude for Ray's friendship. It began with rehabilitating the rope toe, where skiers grasped a large rope and were pulled up to the top of a modest little hill as they clung to the rope. Barely a glorified cow pasture, this little, quote, lift, unquote, was the center of community activities on winter weekends, and the bane of many new skiers who took time to get used to the rope toes. Now, it seems that Ralph and Grace handled the aesthetic side of the partnership, what today they refer to as the public-facing side. Raymond was the engineer who quickly grew Snow's Mountain with the addition of first one and then a second T-bar, one above the other. The first T-bar serviced the intermediate level skiers, and the second for those ready for the challenge of expert terrain. Raymond purchased the T-bars from a Utah ski area and supervised the reconstruction of the tees after they were shipped to New Hampshire. A few years later, Dartmouth graduate and Olympic superstar Tom Corcoran partnered with Ralph Bean and Raymond to develop the Waterville Valley Ski Resort, with the moral and financial support of several other iconic American families who were also involved from the beginning: the Kennedy family of Massachusetts and the Dunphy family of New Hampshire. Later, the Sununu family would lend their support, making it a bipartisan affair. Here's how Bill Brocks, Raymond's son, recalls the partnership developed between Tom Corcoran and Ralph and Raymond.
Like I said, Ralph was looking to expand the mountain, you know, and kind of retire from it all. So, you know, like I said, my father was, you know, kind of a farm boy and stuff. So they were talking about, you know, my father buying or whatever. But eventually, you know, Tom came into the picture. You know, he went to Dartmouth and was on the U.S. ski team. He had a pedigree, unlike my father's. So Tom bought Tom. Well, he didn't. As far as I know, Ralph Bean held the paper on the company. He never actually sold to Tom.
I gotcha. Yep.
But Tom owned it, you know. But Ralph held the paper on it, as they say.
Right.
And my father had my father's value was in the 100-year lease with the state forest. My father sold the lift company and his lease with the state forest to Tom. And I don't know what year that was, but I think that Mount Tecumseh opened up in 1968, I think.
I think that's right, yeah.
So I don't know what year my father sold. After that, my father was out of it, you know.
Uh-huh.
And he ended up opening a golf course down in Methuen, Mass. called Hickory Hill, that my brothers run today.
Looking back, what few people know about the phenomenon that began as hot dog skiing, or just plain hot dogging, and in less than a year morphed into the more sexy and urbane freestyle skiing, is that its rise was a joyful, generous, and welcoming celebration of America's diversity in a sport that had only recently been the lily-white domain of a small elite group of Americans and Europeans who had come to America to introduce it. Until the 1970s, skiing had evolved gradually, beginning with its European roots, followed by a migration of famed European skiers imported into the U.S. specifically to bring their expertise. Much of that, those early years revolved around New Hampshire as well, and perhaps we'll get to that in another series later on. But with the exception of the legendary Stein Erickson, most of the others were still skiing and instructing in the traditional, albeit evolving, manner and method. Erickson gained fame for being the first skier to consistently do flips on skis, making him at least arguably the very first aerial acrobat on skis. So what was so revolutionary about Waterville Valley? It was the people, their common humanity and openness to one another. In short, it was their generosity of heart, spirit, and their love of skiing and the land. It was entire families like the Corcoran family, the Kennedys, the Dunphys, the Du Boises, and later the Sununus. While Ralph Bean still held the paper on the land in Waterville and Raymond Brock's 100-year lease on public land for the ski area and its infrastructure, Corcoran's Waterville Company took command of the development and the growth of the new resort, and grow it did. Tom Corcoran was the commander of the works, but he was also the public face of Waterville Valley, traveling the country to evangelize on behalf of the new resort. Here's how Donnie Hughes described Tom Corcoran's management style. Well, what was Tom Corcoran like? I mean, was he really tightly wound as a...
Well, it's hard to talk. We didn't have that many dealings with him. He was the business exec running the joint.
Yeah. I've been in a couple of meetings with him just because of the academy, you know, and trying to figure out who would get passes and all those kinds of things. And it was interesting to me because he was very, he didn't always talk a lot during a meeting. He would absorb things and then repeat them. And he'd always close a meeting by reiterating what he thought had been summarized and said. And it was an interesting way to make sure that he remembered it correctly and that he would kind of put his spin on it. Do you know what I mean? It would sort of be how he wanted it to be. And that's the way it would be, because that was the end of the meeting.
Yeah. As Tom Corcoran traversed the country on behalf of the Waterville Company, its reputation grew. Meanwhile, back in the, quote, Valley, as it had become known, a group of exciting and sometimes outrageous skiers were birthing the most exciting new development in alpine skiing. Even before Tom Corcoran saw the behemoth that was being created at Waterville Valley, Doug Pfeiffer, editor at Skiing Magazine, who viewed the industry from an even higher plane, saw that something huge was taxiing down the runway. Here's Hall of Famer Wayne Wong telling the story of an early interaction between Tom Corcoran and Doug Pfeiffer that resulted in the very first freestyle competition in 1971.
When you came, you just came to Waterville as sort of a lark, right? I mean, to compete in the,
yeah,
in the first competition.
Yeah. So let me backtrack a little bit to give you a little bit of background that I know of how the sport evolved. Doug Pfeiffer, who was the editor in chief of Skiing Magazine, and Tommy Corcoran were at a ski function in Boston or someplace on the East Coast. I can't remember where. And just in their conversations, they had a discussion about who were the best skiers on the mountain. And Tommy Corcoran, who had just come off of the U.S. Alpine ski team, said, obviously, it's the racers. And Doug Pfeiffer was, you know, kind of the rebellious guy who was involved with, I believe, the startup with a PSIA, Professional Ski Instructors. And he said, Tommy, you know what? I beg to differ with you, because what about the guys that are skiing the moguls? What about the guys that are skiing the backside of the mountain? What about the guys that are doing aerials and flips on skis and stuff? And so the discussion went a little bit further, and they said, you know, Tommy, let's put your money where your mouth is, basically. And you just developed Waterville Valley. Why don't you host the competition to see who really is the hottest skier? And they came to an agreement, and in March of 1971, Waterville hosted the very first, quote, professional freestyle skiing, and actually that was called the National Championships of Exhibition Skiing at that point. And skiing got involved and was able to obtain Chevrolet as a sponsor of the event, and they gave away a Chevrolet Corvette as the main prize. So skiing advertised this competition being held at Waterville to see, you know, basically who the hottest skier on the mountain was. And growing up in Vancouver, and I was only, you know, 21 years old, a ski instructor, my friends all said, hey, Wayne, you've done all these tricks that nobody's ever seen before that, you know, we kind of developed on our local little mountain, because it wasn't we didn't have a lot of vertical. However, the terrain was challenging enough where we could find jumps, we could have mogul skiing, and at that time, I was heavily influenced by the Hart Ski Company ski team, and they had a couple of trick skiers on their team, and the guy in particular was Art Fuhrer, who was magic on skis. He could, you know, dance on the skis. He could do crossovers. He could do Royal Christies. He could do outriggers and all that. And I was absolutely fascinated by what he could do on skis. And so I said, you know, that would be a real challenge for me, because the mountain, you know, itself is really not that challenging. So I started messing around with some of the stuff that I had seen Art Fuhrer and the Hart Freestyle team, or Hart demo team, doing tricks on skis. And as I was doing that, I would accidentally learn things on my own by mistake. Watching some of my students that I was teaching basics, beginners, watching them cross their skis and spin around and land back up on their feet again. And I go, wow, that was pretty cool. And then I'd go out after teaching my lesson, I'd go out with my buddies to ski, and I'd say, hey, I got this guy in my class, and he did this and this and that, and look at this. And, wow, that was a pretty cool trick. So, you know, that's kind of how I started inventing or developing my repertoire of freestyle trick moves. And so I knew at that time that I had accidentally or whatever invented a bunch of tricks that nobody had ever seen before, except my buddies that I skied with on the local mountains. So when this advertisement came on in Skiing Magazine, they said, wait, you got to go do this. You know, we'll help find you a sponsor and get you to Waterville. And, you know, you need to do that because nobody has, other than us, has seen some of your tricks. So I ended up getting a sponsorship from the Vancouver City College, enough to help get a plane ticket from Vancouver to Montreal. And from Montreal, I took a bus to Concord, New Hampshire. And I had no idea where Waterville Valley was at that time. All I did was I stuck a dart in the map and said, I need to get here. I was 21 years old. I had a backpack on my back. Ended up in downtown Concord, New Hampshire, about 3 o'clock in the morning. That's a whole story in itself, how I got to Waterville, you know. And it's pretty cool. I ended up at Waterville, and I was befriended by Paul Fosey, who was a ski school director there, and an instructor named Bob Giel, who kind of walked me around Waterville and showed me places, you know, and things around the town. But anyways, the event itself at that time was based on True Grit, and it was a top to bottom run. And the format was whatever you could do to impress the judges was up to you. And there was no specialized discipline. It was just a start to the bottom. And you know, as you know, True Grit was very steep and mogly in the top stretch. And then it kind of rolled in the middle part where there were some big rolls and the work rows and stuff. And then it kind of rolled down to a nice, gentle, flat area at the beginning. I mean, at the bottom of a hill. And it was based on the best two out of three runs and the best two runs to count. And whatever you did to, you know, impress the judges was up to your creativity, which that is the key to the whole freestyle movement is creativity and spontaneity. And there was, I believe, 44 or 46 competitors. And for me, I came to this event hoping to see some of my ski heroes and hang out with some of my ski heroes that I'd seen in the movies and the magazines. And for me, that was at that time, that was reward enough. And the fact that, you know, if I could get out on the ski hill and ski with these guys, would be even better. But you know, there were guys like Tommy Leroy, Bobby Burns, Weems Welsfeld, Susie Chaffee, you know, to name a few from the Heart demo team. I was just blown away, just, you know, being able to walk around with all these heroes in the same ski lodge, nevertheless, never mind just getting out on the hill and competing against them. So yeah. Anyhow, go ahead.
Wayne Wong finished second in that competition that year. Took home a mere $1,000. But can you imagine what it was like for a young 21-year-old student who had been sponsored by his friends and his college to come to this competition and to be judged by Jean-Claude Killy, who had excited the entire world only 2 years earlier by becoming the first skier ever to win gold medals in the downhill slalom and giant slalom events of the Olympics. What a thrill. And it would set the course for Wayne Wong for the rest of his career. Just like that, the fire had been lit. Hot dogging, already morphing into the more mainstream freestyle, was catching fire all over. And many resorts were hustling to be sure they caught a piece of the action. One of those resorts was Stratton Mountain in Vermont. They tried to step out ahead of the other mountains by holding an exhibition of aerial skiing in 1970, looking to jump the queue. But the very technical job of designing the jumps for an aerial competition was more complicated than they had realized. Freestyle was catching fire, and it looked like aerials were going to be the big show. But in one terrible moment on Mount Stratton, a crippling accident involving aerialist Dirk Douglas quite literally broke the back of both Douglas and nearly the future of freestyle skiing. In the next episode, we'll meet the protectors and the mentors who saved freestyle and assured its future. Thanks for joining us on New Hampshire Secrets, Legends, and Lore for this special presentation on the birth of freestyle skiing. My thanks to John and Donnie Hughes and Wayne Wong and Bill Brocks for speaking with me about their respective pieces of the story. And we'll hear more next week from others, including Wayne Wong and Frank Du Bois and George Askewold, about how they revived freestyle skiing at its darkest moment. The show notes for this podcast can be found at nhsecrets.blogspot.com, where you can make a contribution to the podcast, subscribe to the podcast, purchase images that help support us. Or send us an email if you have ideas about other stories that we should be doing, whether they relate to freestyle skiing or other things. I'm so grateful for your support of this podcast. And we'll see you again on the next episode of New Hampshire Secrets, Legends, and Lore.